Elon Musk says artificial intelligence will take all of our jobs in the future, and he called AI technology his biggest fear. We'll tell you more coming up on Business Matters. Good Friday afternoon, and thank you so much for being here with me today. I'm your host, Don Ma. Starting with stocks here, it rebounded today from sharp losses of the day previously. Now, the NASDAQ saw its fifth straight week of gains and record closing high. So, you know, economic data today has come in a little bit better than people thought earlier in the day. And this bounce that we're seeing is perhaps people, you know, feeling like perhaps things aren't as bad. Maybe there's room for the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates. The Dow, on the other hand, snapped its five-week rally a day after registering its largest daily percentage decline in over a year. And trading volumes also were subdued ahead of the Memorial Day market holiday on Monday. Besides the markets, let's talk about Boeing here real quick. It saw a six-fold increase from its employees raising concerns about the safety of products and services during the first 2 months of 2024. And this is compared with the same period last year, according to the plane maker earlier today. Now, this dramatic rise in reports occurred after the incident on January 5th involving a Boeing 737 MAX 9 jet. Boeing, at the same time, is also burning cash due to these safety concerns. Yesterday, the company's finance chief said that this year's plane deliveries will not increase in the second quarter. And moving on to Google. It's walking back some factually incorrect search results after launching its new artificial intelligence search tool called Gemini. So this tool summarizes search results so that users don't have to click through multiple links. But, you know, this week, the feature came under fire after it provided false or misleading information to some questions. Now, let me give you an example here. A user posted that a summary incorrectly stated that none of Africa's 54 recognized countries start with the letter K. Actually, Kenya, which is part of that, does start with the letter K. Google says the wrong summaries have been removed. Moving on from that, universal high income but lives that lack meaning. Elon Musk predicting that AI will bring a socialist post-scarcity economy, citing a 1980 science fiction book. Now, NTD's Virginia Gibson will tell us more about that.
Is there a future in which few of us will have jobs? That's what Elon Musk told the 2024 Viva Tech conference in France on Thursday. He predicted that AI would eventually lead to universal high income and an abundance of goods and services.
Everyone will have access to as much in the way of goods and services as they would like. The question will really be one of meaning. Of how, if the computer can do, and the robots can do everything better than you, then does your life have meaning?
Musk brought up the science fiction series The Culture by Scottish author Ian Banks. He called it the most accurate portrayal of a future with superintelligent AI. The Culture is about a future spacefaring socialist civilization. Advanced artificial intelligences called minds control society. 30 trillion humanoids live across multiple planets and ships. They can live for 400 years, don't need money, and work is optional.
If you want to do a job as kind of like a hobby, you can do a job. But otherwise, the AI and the robots will provide any goods and services that you want.
Musk called this the benign scenario. He also described a negative scenario where humanity is in deep trouble. Musk has previously called AI an existential risk for human civilization. In the near future, Musk said he worries about how AI is being built.
You build it with values. I'm concerned about sort of the values that sort of a Microsoft, OpenAI, or frankly, Google are programming.
Musk said programming explicit morality is a problem because those morals can quickly be inverted. He emphasized that truth cannot be inverted and AIs should be programmed to maximally seek the truth. Virginia Gibson, NTD News.
All right, what's next? The Securities and Exchange Commission has approved applications to list exchange-traded funds tied to Ether, and that is the second largest cryptocurrency. And this will potentially pave the way for the products to begin trading later this year. Besides the exchanges, the issuers of the ETF also have to get the green light. But this approval, nevertheless, a major surprise win for those firms and the crypto industry. Ether itself could also get a boost because investors already poured more than $30 billion into crypto exchange-traded funds since the SEC approved Bitcoin ETFs. Now, the U.S. Defense Department is spending millions of dollars every single year on consulting services. But national security experts have raised concerns of unnecessary bloat here, as well as conflict of interest, since the consulting firms also work with foreign companies, including state-owned companies. And this is a very important topic. For more insight, I spoke to Cale Brown. He is the senior advisor at Polaris National Security. It's a nonprofit organization founded by Morgan Ortegas, a former State Department spokesperson under President Trump. Take a look. Cale, thank you so much for your time today. I read your article, and the first question I have is, how much is the DOD spending on consulting?
You know, the most recent information that I've seen about DOD spending on consultancies is from around 2022 to 23. And it estimated that spending to be around $1.2 billion. And what I would point out is that that's just part of a larger problem across government that appears to be growing. It was last year about this time that the Daily Mail ran a story about the rate of spending and how it was increasing under the Biden administration. Such that at the 27-month mark, the current administration had spent $50 billion, whereas the Trump administration in 4 years had spent about $66 billion. So it's a lot of government money being spent on this, and the rate at which being spent seems to be increasing.
So in your article, you mentioned specific reasons for concern with this. Can you just tell our viewers what some of those concerns are?
Sure. Now, spending alone is an issue that I'm concerned with. But the thing that I think really motivated me to write was the announcement of McKinsey's involvement with a sort of overarching study that the Department of the Air Force had enlisted their help with. And you know, part of the problem is they were looking at how to re-optimize the Air Force. This is a sort of a how does the Air Force plan to be in the future. I know this is the type of work that people who are in that service are focused on a daily basis. So it seemed to me it was fairly duplicative. The other problem is that McKinsey has developed a reputation for dealing in conflicts of interest. And so their selection for this contract I found particularly troubling.
And what is that conflict of interest?
Well, here in particular, since about 2021, lawmakers have brought up concerns about McKinsey's foreign consulting, and not just, you know, consulting overseas, but actually consulting in adversarial countries, Russia, China, and not necessarily with government, but with firms that have close ties to the government. For instance, they're connected in China to the China Construction Bank and the China Resources Holding Company, which have close ties to the CCP, and also the China Communication Construction Company, which was one of the firms that was pivotal in the buildup of the artificial island chain in the South China Sea. And they've had an ongoing consultancy relationship with this firm. You have to ask yourself, how much do you trust the advice you're getting from a firm that maybe at the same time in a different part of their company also providing advice to entities that would find themselves on the opposite side of a conflict?
The conflict of interest is very obvious, at least to me, now that you point it out. So, I mean, is anything being done here to address that concern?
I don't see that there's been any action taken. DOD's continued business with McKinsey tells me that that they seem to have accepted those explanations. So I don't know that action's being taken, but I think that the department really should evaluate whether this is the kind of organization they want to be taking advice from, certainly when it comes at the cost, the sticker price that McKinsey will put on it.
Cale, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you for your service, and it was great speaking with you.
Thanks. It was great to be with you.
Continue with this story, actually, I want to give you some background. In a Senate hearing earlier this year, McKinsey was asked about its relationship with the Chinese regime. Let's take a look at that exchange.
Mr. Sernfels, it's my understanding that McKinsey has a significant relationship with the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese military, that you do significant work for them. What assurances can McKinsey give to this committee that McKinsey is committed to America and not the China Communist Party?
Senator, we do no work, and to the best of my knowledge, never have, for the Chinese Communist Party or for the central government in China. The vast majority of work that we do in China is for multinational companies. Many of those are U.S. companies and private sector Chinese companies.
None of these companies are owned or subsidiaries or partially owned by the CCP?
Not to my knowledge, Senator.
We also reached out to McKinsey. We'll let you know when they respond. Coming up, access to affordable housing, a nationwide challenge, and New York City being the worst for renters here. And in college sports, a landmark settlement that allows schools to pay their athletes that could end the NCAA's long-held amateur model. NTD's Dave Martin joins us to discuss when we return. All right, welcome back. Let me go through some rapid-fire headlines with you on what else is happening today. Shares of Dell Technologies hit a record high today amid a rally in companies working on generative artificial intelligence applications. It was buoyed as well by strong optimism for this new technology. And fake accounts posting about the U.S. presidential election are proliferating on social media platform X. This is according to a new study. Now, in total, the report found that around 1 in 5 accounts that are either praising or criticizing Biden or Trump are fake. Capital One Financial will no longer be the exclusive issuer of Walmart-branded credit cards, the company said earlier today. They scrapped their agreement following disputes. Okay, a quick China-related story here. The Taiwanese people and markets are unfazed by China's punishment drills today. Those drills are in response to Taiwan's new president, Lai Ching-te, or William Lai. So what's happening is China staged mock missile strikes in waters east of Taiwan and dispatched fighter jets carrying live missiles, according to state media. Beijing tested its ability to, quote, seize power and control key areas of Taiwan in these drills. But, you know, on the island of 23 million people, life continued as normal with no overt sign of any worry. The Taiwanese has gotten used to having decades of living under Chinese threats. Meanwhile, Taiwan's benchmark index, also at a historic high, scarcely impacted, it seems like, by China's drills. Now, moving on from that, single-family home prices in the U.S. and rental costs in the Northeast and New York City are the highest in this nation. This is according to S&P Global Ratings. Buyers and sellers remained on the sidelines in 2023 as conventional mortgage rates peaked at more than 7% for 17 weeks. And on top of all that, not to mention the low single-family housing supply. To get a better sense of exactly what is happening here, I spoke to Nora Woodstruck, U.S. Public Finance Managing Director at S&P Global Ratings. Here she is. All right, Nora, thank you so much for your time today, this afternoon. So S&P Global Ratings released this new report on housing affordability, and apparently it's not looking so good. National challenges here. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for having me on today. Yeah, I mean, I think that we see that housing affordability is a nationwide issue. A lot of that stems from the higher for longer interest rate environment. I think also it's just stemming from the fact that if you do have a very low mortgage, like I do, luckily, that maybe you secured in late 2020, you really are not interested in moving because you don't want to remortgage if you have to move. So that's creating a lot of issues around inventory generally. And I think, you know, what our report points out is that it's a little bit worse in New York City. Our city is kind of constrained by land area. So it's hard to have a lot of new space to develop housing units. And in addition to that, you know, we also have some issues around labor and prevailing wage requirements that also keep costs of development a little bit higher in the city than they might be. And then finally, you know, we do pay a lot of transaction taxes when we buy and sell houses in the city, which are higher than I would say most places in the U.S.
So basically what's happening here is we have low inventory with high demand, and people are being locked out of buying a home because prices are just so high. Is that right?
I would say that's correct. I think that's a good way to put it. I would also say that, you know, just generally our purchase prices in the Northeast are higher than they are in almost every region in the U.S. So we do have very high demand, particularly for affordable units that for people that have, you know, lower levels of income, where your household income might be, you know, below 100,000, there's a very finite number of units that are available for people at that price to rent. And so it challenges people in that particular income bracket even a little bit more.
So the problems here that we're discussing, how long would you forecast that this would continue into the future?
Well, I'm not an economist or a real estate analyst, so I probably don't have a great idea about that. But I think, you know, it's probably, you know, something that's not going to end soon for the city, and probably will be a longer term horizon on how those solutions take hold over time.
So if that's the case, if these problems persist for longer, what would the consequences be if this went into the long term?
I mean, I think we do view the state's demographic and economic growth as being somewhat dependent upon being able to ensure that there's sufficient housing affordable for all levels of individuals at all income brackets. I think demographics can change sort of incrementally over time, which at the end of the day, with the city collecting income taxes based on the people that live here, you know, that can be a meaningful change for the types of revenues that they can collect. You know, the city has always done a very good job prioritizing their resources within, you know, the way that they generate revenues and their operational expenditures. So the fact that the mayor and the city council and other folks in the city are thinking about how to solve this issue is important in our view when it comes to their credit quality.
All right, I think that's a pretty good note to end on here. Nora, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The World Health Organization sounding the alarm about how the tobacco industry targets youth, creating a new wave of addiction. NTD's Sean Marshall has more.
Hey, got some words of warning for you about a little industry called big tobacco.
The World Health Organization is warning how the tobacco industry is trying to capture the next generation. It highlights how big tobacco marketing is targeting youth with vaping and e-cigs.
The industry is exploiting digital and social media, delivery apps, and other innovative ways to reach our children. At the same time, they are continuing with old tricks, such as giving away free samples to recruit a new generation as customers. Tobacco and related industries use child-friendly flavors, like cotton candy and bubblegum, to attract young consumers.
In the WHO European region, e-cigarettes have overtaken conventional cigarettes in popularity, with 32% of 15-year-olds surveyed reporting e-cigarette use at some point, and 20% in the past 30 days.
But this is Naruto. Naruto is a comic figure in Indonesia, very well known. And that speaks to my grandchild rather than to me, I would say.
The WHO report also notes internal tobacco industry documents dating as far back as the 1970s show that tobacco companies have long considered children and youth to be replacement smokers, pre-smokers, and a critical market to sustaining their business and the future of their brands. Sean Marshall, NTD News.
And now, the best for last for your business and sports news. We're joined by the always insightful Dave Martin. Dave, good to see you. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me on.
All right, let me ask you here. The NCAA announcing an agreement to settle three pending antitrust cases. And that will allow schools to pay their players for the first time ever. How do you think this is going to shape college athletics?
I think it's really going to separate the haves from the have-nots, even more so. You know, this settlement hasn't been okayed yet by the judge, but it's reported to be for nearly $3 billion, with some of that in back damage. So the NCAA is reportedly going to play part of that, with the rest being mainly footed by the four power conference schools. Now, according to documents obtained by Yahoo Sports, those schools in the power conferences are expected to pay as much as $30 million a year over the next 10 years to cover the back damages, plus the revenue sharing with the players and scholarship costs. Now, that $30 million, that is a huge amount. Now, if you've been following college sports realignment, we've gone from the Power 5 conferences down to the Power 4 after the demise of the Pac-12. But among those four, there's really a gap between in TV revenue between the Big Ten and SEC, what they get, and the Big 12 and the ACC. Now, the Big 12 and ACC reportedly get between $40 to $45 million in TV revenue per year. If $30 million is taken right off the top of that, that's going to be very difficult to top right under.
Well, Dave, here's the thing. It was just 3 years ago that the NCAA decided to allow players to profit from their name, image, and likeness. What do you think has turned the tide so quickly that now having schools pay their players?
You know, I think the tide was already turning. Maybe they thought the name, image, likeness was kind of stem it for a while. It certainly didn't. I think these massive TV deals that some of these conferences have signed has really put a lot of public pressure really on the whole system. You know, the Big Ten signed 7-year agreements with Fox, CBS, and NBC, this is in 2022, worth a combined $7 billion. Now, last fiscal year, they brought in $880 million. That figure is expected to jump next year when they bring in USC and UCLA in. It's really tough to say you can't afford to pay your players with that kind of money being thrown around publicly. Now, keep in mind, this settlement agreement to have their schools pay their players, they're allowing that. I think competition is probably going to force it, but reportedly it would be capped at around $20 million a year out of that $30 million. If that's the case, it really puts the Big Ten and SEC schools at significant advantages over everyone else, especially the Big 12 and ACC.
Well, Dave, lived up to your name. Very insightful. Thank you very much today.
Well, thank you very much, Don.
All right, and that's all the stories we have for you today. Thank you very much for staying with us and watching on this Friday afternoon. Goodbye.